Okay, this is January 11th, 1989, and today I'm interviewing Earl Herring, a recently retired Vice President for Administration of Morehead State University, as a part of the Heritage Center, or the Heritage Commission's Oral History Project. I'm Bill Jones. Earl, I think it would be helpful first if you just gave us a brief rundown of your career, the important spots along the way for your career.
All right, I'll give you a little background. I come from Minneapolis, born in 1928, attended school there, graduated from Roosevelt High in 1946, served 2 years in the Navy as an aviation machinist mate right after World War II, attended Stout Institute at that time, Stout State University of Menominee,
University of Wisconsin at Menominee, and got a bachelor's degree and a bachelor's in 1952 and a master's in 1953 from Stout. And went on my first jobs at where we should be going.
That's where we should be going. Okay. Right. You're educated and ready to go now.
Right? Educated and ready to go. First job was at Minot State College, now Minot State University in North Dakota. And I taught industrial arts and was there from 1952 to 1956. And the last year I was there, I served as, besides teaching, as the Dean of Men. And then I left Minot in 1956 and went to Hibbing Community College and headed up an industrial technology program, a new program there. And I was hired there by John Neumeyer, who was the dean. They called them deans at that time rather than the president. But he was the head institutional officer. I was part of the Hibbing School District at that time. And I was there for 3 years, from 1956 to 1959.
What was your responsibility there?
Well, I had varying responsibilities, primarily teaching in industrial technology. It was a two-year program. Where the graduates would go out, and many of them went into the mining industry as, junior engineers and technical people, basic background in some math, science, and drawing, and were mainly hired by mining companies. And that's just about the time, 1959, when some of the first big strikes hit the mining industry, and it was kind of after that time, not because of the strikes, but because of the availability of foreign ore and also the declining quality of Mesabi Range ore, that the iron mining areas of northeastern Minnesota kind of went downhill, and jobs and employment in general became much more difficult to get. In addition to teaching, I also served as the registrar and the placement director while I was there. So
they got a lot from you, I can see. And then you moved to?
And in 1959, I moved to Morehead. That was a year after John Neumeyer became president and at Morehead State in 1958. And that year, he had invited me over for an interview. And then I was hired in the spring of 1959 and started work at Morehead State College at that time as of July 1st, 1959. And my title, as I came into the position, was assistant to the president. But essentially, in the entire tenure at Morehead State, I had similar administrative responsibilities, but I had several different titles. I think the first title change was in 1962. I became Dean of Administrative Affairs. And then in 1972, that became Vice President for Administrative Affairs.
Let's talk about Morehead State in 1959 when you arrived. Obviously, a physical plant was a major concern of yours. What buildings didn't we have? I think it'd be easier, wouldn't it?
Well, the when I came, we had, I believe it was about 8 or 9 buildings. And essentially the major buildings were the campus school and Weld Addition and Weld Hall, McLean Hall, Frick Hall, the three residence halls, Comstock and Wheeler Hall and Ballard Hall. And then we had some married student housing and tropical type metal huts. Mm-hmm. And Dahl Hall was also just finished when I came.
Comstock and Wheeler.
They were two older dorms built, one in the late 1800s and the other in the early 1900s, and they were a residence for men and one for women, and they had the dining services in the basement of, I believe it was Comstock Hall. And those buildings were removed in about 1964 to make room for the Center for the Arts, which was, they projected out into what is now the mall, but they also kind of overlapped where the Center for the Arts is located. So they were raised then, and the Center for the Arts built. And so basically there have been about 18 or 19 major buildings. I think there were about 8 here when I came, and there's about 28 now, so 19, 20 buildings have been constructed, and some were under construction. 2 or 3 were under construction when I arrived in 1959.
Was the concept of the mall, was that pretty well established by the time you arrived?
It was, the concept was established. We had, as I mentioned, these two buildings that, the mall was smaller. It was about two-thirds of its present size. That part to the west end of the mall existed, but then it kind of ran up against Wheeler and Comstock Halls. And the decision was made about that time to keep the mall as it is, but expand it and to place the new library, now Livingston Lord Library, in the center towards the east end of the mall, and to keep that area then open and keep it dedicated as a mall. And as the campus grew, the enrollment grew and so forth, there was always a temptation, and some people wished to put buildings into the mall to keep them in close proximity, but that we always resisted that and did maintain the mall as we know today.
Actually, it's certainly one of the things that distinguishes Morehead State from the other state universities. That
it is,
yeah,
right.
It's really worked out very well. You arrived here, brought here by President Neumeier. What kind of an institution was it then, and what size, and what's your impression of the institution as an educational institution at that point?
Well, when I first came, I was pretty impressed, but by comparison to now, it was a pretty small institution. We had, as I recall, slightly more than 1,000 students here, just over 1,000 in the fall of 1959. And as I mentioned, we had the 8 or 9 buildings that comprised the total campus at that time. The institution was coming from its background as a teacher's college and pretty much oriented in the from the point of view of programs to the teachers' colleges of that day. And when John Neumeier came in with a new philosophy about what the best, what kind of an institution we should have, the state should have in this part of the state to serve the students. So he really brought some rather new and radical ideas to what had been a teacher's college in the past. Mm-hmm. And was moving towards a transition to become a more broader-based college at that time. And he came with a commitment to the liberal arts that was, I think, I won't say there weren't a lot of people in the administration, the faculty prior to that, that were not interested and committed to the liberal arts, but I think the presidents, for the most part, have been of a different backgrounds and commitments, and John did start right off to work towards academic departments that were more related to the academic disciplines rather than what might be a divisional type approach.
Mm-hmm.
And John was also committed to bring in the best faculty that he could attract. And if, when I say the best faculty, that was in his, you know, from his point of view, what was best. And he looked for academic scholarly types of faculty members, strong in their discipline, with PhDs whenever possible. But because Morehead State was a small institution and out on the plains, and attempting to attract faculty from major universities strong in their disciplines, sometimes he had to take chances on the faculty that he was hiring. But he was involved in all of the, in those first years at least, in all of the hiring and trying to draw those types of faculty members that he felt would best serve the students and to broaden their educational.
I'm curious, as I think about his impact, which was considerable, was this pretty much a unilateral decision on his part? This is the direction that this school should take, and I'm going to do everything I can to push it in that direction? Or was there a board direction which established this, or how did it work? Some presidents obviously went one way. As I look it over, Winona kind of stayed in the Teachers College status for a much longer time, as did Bemidji, much longer time than Morehead, for example. Is this just the impact of one strong personality with one educational philosophy, or were there directives?
Well, I think you'd have to say that it started somewhat with the State College Board at that time. Roy Prentice was its executive director, and I think the first executive director that really served to start the coordination of the universities had been pretty much separate elements with some financial coordination from a board office. But at that time, the board office was increasing its responsibilities and its direction with regard to the universities. And I remember I was at Hibbing when Roy Prentice came up to interview John Neumeier, and one of the other candidates for the presidency at Morehead State was Cap Lura, Dr. Lura, who had been a dean of men at Morehead State and then had gone to become president at Minot. And so I knew him quite well from my days at Minot.
Hmm.
So Roy Prentice asked me offhandedly at Hibbing what I thought of Dr. Lura, and I told him, wonderful man, he'd make a great president. I didn't realize he was there interviewing John Neumeier for the presidency, so I was kidded about that quite a bit. But to get back to your question, I think that the board conducted careful interviews, and it seemed as though they selected John, knowing of his background and his commitment. And so I think the board did have an impact by hiring John, but I don't think he had any direction from the board to as to what kind of an institution they wanted Morehead to be from the educational point of view and program point of view. And John, I think, while not single-handedly, because he certainly had supporters within the faculty and administration, but he had many who were dragging their feet very, very strongly at the types of changes that he was bringing. So I would say that he had an unusually strong commitment and determination to change Morehead State, and I think that he did it.
It would seem also then that each of the schools had a little more autonomy than possibly later on.
I think that's true that they did. From the point of view of budgets, in some ways that wasn't the case. They had a controller in St. Paul with the small board office, but you had to go and get the money from that source. And as far as knowing what your allocations were going to be and what you could depend on, we didn't have as much control then as we do now. We were not able to forecast as well. We would always wait to hear what the controller was going to give us, and if we had a problem, we'd have to go there. So we didn't have as as much control of our resources at that time as came in later mm-hmm. years. But overall, from a point of view of rules and regulations and policies that govern all the campuses now, we didn't have those, and so each of the campuses had more autonomy from many points of view, but mm-hmm. not fiscally.
Let's talk about resources, too, at that time. Clearly, that was an administrative responsibility you had as far as the finances of the school. And the legislature was the source of those resources. What was the relationship at that time with the legislature as far as Neumeier, as far as you were concerned?
Well, those were different. Those were different times than mm-hmm. the last 20 years. When I came, and it would be the various state colleges, the presidents and other administrative officers that would frequently go to St. Paul during legislative sessions, which were held on odd-numbered years only at that time. And the presidents and their associates would testify before legislative committees. And at that time, the air service wasn't what it is now, but on the other hand, the railroad service was much better. But during legislative sessions, John and I and sometimes others would spend 20-30 hours a week on the Red River train. We'd get on at 5:30 in the evening here in Moorhead, and it'd take about 5 hours to get to St. Paul, and then we would testify the next day before various committees. And and back the next evening, we get on the train at 5:30 again and get back in town about 11 o'clock. So we had much more, the presidents and administrative officers had much more direct contact at that time with legislators and legislative committees. I'm not saying it was better or mm-hmm. worse, but that's the way it was at that time. And in fact, it wouldn't work now to have that same type of individual colleges coming in and making their separate presentations.
Mm-hmm. About when did that change, when the chancellor became the contact with the legislature?
Well, I would say probably when Bevington Reed was the chancellor, and I don't think he was called, I think he was still called the executive director of the State College Board at that time. But it would probably be during the, and I can't recall the exact dates when Roy Prentice moved out and the other people moved in, but it'd be the late 60s and the early 70s. That's when the changes were taking place. And then when Theodore Mitau was the mm-hmm. chancellor, I would say that was the a major consolidation then. And at that time, it was infrequent that more than it was the chancellor's office that made the presentations to the legislature, coordinated the preparation of the written materials and the budgets and the building request, and then were the primary people to testify, although frequently the presidents were available to talk about specific needs during mm-hmm. those years too. But I think as the system grew and the complexity of the higher education grew and the Higher Education Coordinating Board came into existence, all of those things moved towards a centralization of program requests and presentations in the mm-hmm. legislature.
Let's talk a little bit about administrative style. How did you work with Neumeier, and what kind of a boss was he?
Well, I had known John, of course, 2 years earlier from Hibbing Community College, where we worked together. And he asked me to come for an interview, and at that time our resident director, we had resident directors then, and Norm Nelson, who was later Judge Nelson of this district.
On the board, director. Not,
he was a resident director on the Minnesota mm-hmm. State College Board. I remember being interviewed by John and some faculty and Norm Nelson, and I came over. And I was very young and relatively inexperienced in the job that I was hired for. But John gave me, delegated a great deal of authority, perhaps more than he should have under the conditions. But I worked hard, and those first years. In fact, the first 10 years were, it was an all day and half the night and every weekend type of job. And our staffing
we were building a campus.
Yeah. At that time, enrollments were going up, I think, between 12% to 20% every year. And we were always behind on financing. We were financed on the basis of the previous year at best, and maybe 2 years back. So we were underfinanced, and our facilities were way behind. And staffing, and that resulted in staffing. I was the personnel officer, and I was in charge of the facilities and new construction, which was going hot and heavy. It's one of the reasons why we spent so much time on the going to St. Paul, too, on the train, sure. Is that we'd be going down to meet with the state architect or testify about buildings, or we had a coordinating architect, Dick Hamill and St. Paul offices. We were down there on that. But it was a tremendous demand. It was perhaps the years, you know, those were really, that was really the challenge, was to try to keep the campus going, keep the faculty, get the money so we could hire the faculty we needed for the students, and to determine what type of facilities we needed, where we were going to grow, and get the funds for that, and get the architects to develop plans that were agreeable to all the different agencies, but also to our faculty that were involved in that, and then to get those projects built. And but John did delegate those things. I could talk to him about buildings and finances, and he would always listen politely and have comments. But if I wanted to get his attention, I'd talk about people or persons, sure. Or personnel, and that's where his that's where his interest. And so. Mm-hmm. While I'm sure that he was devoting a heavy proportion of his time to the development of academic programs, the hiring of faculty, and I kind of worked closely with him, but I had a lot of authority to move ahead in these areas on my own.
Who are some of the key people that you worked with in your area during that period?
Well, we had, by comparison, we had a total classified staff when I came of 25 people, and today we have probably well over 250 people. So you can see we operated on a very thin margin, and I shared one secretary with Wilbur Williams, who was the later the vice president for academic affairs, and that person was greatly overloaded, and so it was very difficult to get the things accomplished. But the people that I remember at that time working with, and Ardenberg was hired as a business manager in about 19. My first business manager was Morris Zulsdorf, mm-hmm. and who was from Moorhead here, and he left about 1964 and went into Fargo school system as a teacher, and Ardenberg was then hired as a business manager. And that was a tremendous relief to move ahead in the finance area with a person who had been trained in the business area and had considerable experience out west in the state of Washington and Idaho working with businesses and so forth. So that was some of the first real basic relief, and I remember Arden well for that. And then mm-hmm. Dwayne Greer is another person from back in those early years, and he was a heating engineer, and his father, Ben Greer, was in charge of the physical plant. And then in later years, Ben retired, and Dwayne moved up into that position. So there was another key person in the physical plant area. And then Les Johnson, we hired Les, who was an architect who worked for Foss Associates, and he brought a unique expertise to the area of construction and design, that whole area. And between Dwayne and Les, then I was developing a staff, and I was young. I didn't understand how important it was to have a staff to do all these things. I thought I was supposed to do all this
sure.
myself. And as we started to grow, and the allocations for classified people growing and start comparing with other universities, then we started adding some of these people, and that was really a good thing for the university. Going back to the Bob Hansen, of course, in the later the Vice President for Academic Affairs, and following that the President of Winona State University. He and I came at the same time, and we were, I think he came in June of 59 and I came in July, so he always had a couple of months of seniority on me. But we just hit it off from the start, and we worked carefully together. He came as a registrar, and then later he moved up the academic administrative ranks. Worked with him just very closely in those early years. Wilbur Williams was the chief academic officer at that time. And people like the secretary I mentioned that we shared between Bill Williams, myself, Irene Hexum, was an invaluable person. She just had an ability to produce work that you just could hardly overload her. She just got everything done that had to be done, and a key person. So in the early years, those are the people that that come to mind right now.
As you think of the, you know, those, obviously those early years when the university was starting to come of age, college at that time, the role obviously must have changed considerably. And as I look at it now, you know, it is a comprehensive university. It does have a wide variety of degree programs. It does draw from a considerable geographical base. And it does have a status, I think, within the Fargo-Moorhead community that is considerably more exalted than it once was. Was that vision that we were going to move to that the status of today, was that a vision that was shared as early as Neumeier? And when were you more and more conscious that this was happening, the kind of evolution of community attitudes, of breadth of program, and breadth of geographical base?
Well, when I came, I just kind of came in neutral, not knowing much about Moorhead State, Moorhead State College at all. But I could tell, you know, from living and participating in the community and so forth, and the various people I'd work with, that the college image was another teacher's college, and I would say many times unfavorably compared and academic strengths with other colleges, Concordia and sometimes NDSU, and some other colleges in Minnesota. Didn't have any better or any worse reputation, I think, from academic strength. And in the first years, I could just, looking back, see this start to change as, and I give John Neumeier a lot of credit for this and his commitment, because he was a an effective speaker. He laid out the goals that he would like to move towards, creating a stronger liberal arts, strong liberal arts background for the students, and improved programs and strong faculty. And he talked about these things all the time, whether it was on campus or off campus or before the legislature. And I think that kind of imbued us all with the feeling of direction. And then we were also fortunate to see things happening too, where new faculty would be hired, they would be impressive people, direction laid out before the legislature. I mentioned earlier about appearing before legislative committees. John was not bashful about going before committees and telling them what his dream was and what Moorhead State should be and how he could improve it. And he always talked, and he was always, you know, in the final analysis, what he could do for the students who were going to attend Moorhead State. It was not a personal thing with him, that he was out building a reputation for himself. And so when he talked to the legislators, he was talking to them that I'm serving your sons and daughters. In order to do that, we need the resources and so forth. And Peter Popovich, who is now the new Chief Justice of the Minnesota Supreme Court, was the chair of a major committee in the House on Education. And he and John used to really get into it and before some of these committee hearings. And John talked about, he had two primary efforts in the early years in the legislature, and that was to raise faculty salaries and to decrease the student-teacher ratio, which was up towards, I would guess, it was maybe towards 22 or 24 to 1, something like that, 20 students for each faculty member. And he wanted that lowered. And in fact, that, of all the issues, that was the most important one to John. And after he had presented his testimony one morning, Mr. Popovich said, well, now, you can't have both of these. If you can only have one, which one would you take, the lower student-teacher ratio or improvement of faculty salaries? And he said, I cannot choose one over the other. We need them both, and I cannot take any stand other than we need both better salaries and improved ratios. And that went.
It was convincing.
That was convincing. And, mm-hmm. And he, his intellect and his ability to communicate and his interest in providing, the interest in the state of Minnesota and providing an interest in education were there, and they were convincing, and so he was effective.
Now, if the community was asked what Neumeier's contribution was, one of the first things they would talk about is that he brought all those black people mm-hmm. to Morehead State. Mm-hmm. Did you have any, what was your experience relative to that particular part of the
Well, I was perhaps less directly involved in that than several other key people on the campus. But there, too, John would sit down and spend a lot of time talking. And I remember that on Saturdays or something like that, we'd get together in an office or we would go out and even play tennis a few times and talk. And he talked about these things that he wanted to do. And I would act as a little bit of a sounding board and would bring out perhaps some of the points that he was going to be faced with, such as community reaction and what type of students were going to be brought in. I mean, were they going to be academically qualified so they had a good chance of success? And we had long discussions, and he said, well, you know, we'd like to do that, to bring in the academically talented, but we have to bring people in with the potential rather than have demonstrated any real academic aptitude up to this point or not. We're going to have to kind of cut across the lines here and bring in the people that we can get and try to help them. Now, we're not going to bring anybody in who's obviously going to fail and so forth. And so he moved ahead on the program with knowledge that it was going to stir the waters and there were going to be a lot of people critical and a lot of important people in Morehead and Fargo that would not like this turn of events as being rather foreign to the Fargo-Morehead area and what we were up to. And that didn't, the concern about negative reaction never caused him to vary at all. But on the other hand, he tried to be realistic in how successful a program could be and what he could do for these students and what he could do for the state and trying to break down some of the barriers and the inequalities and the prejudice that would exist. He felt this was very important. He also made special efforts to hire foreign faculty members for the mm-hmm. same reason, not that they were going to be necessarily well accepted or popular in this area, but that he felt that it was an important part of the students' education. And Project Equality was certainly intended to educate the rest of the students as well as the minority students he would be bringing in.
One of the fascinating things about Neumeier that I've always wondered about, clearly he had very radical political beliefs, at least the Neumeier that I came to know very casually in mm-hmm. the later days. Was that Neumeier in evidence, and how did that sit with a relatively conservative community that Morehead is?
Well, I think that John did change and grow, and some of his earlier beliefs were modified and so forth. John, I guess the way I would think about him when he came here, that from a point of view of most areas, he was liberal. But in some areas, he was conservative. And I think educationally, his educational philosophy in the early years was fairly, I don't know if conservative is the right word, but traditional.
Mm-hmm.
And he always was concerned about the standards of the university. And he did implement programs that basically stood the years that in order to be admitted to Morehead State in a degree program and so forth, you had to have certain potential as indicated through high school graduation, the upper half of the class, or certain test scores to be admitted to the program. But he also, while he was making moves in that direction, which I guess I would tend to regard as maybe a conservative traditional approach to education, he was working hard to provide alternative avenues for students who didn't meet those qualifications so that when they did prove themselves, then they could move into the regular university baccalaureate programs and so forth. As the years went by, and there were 10 years that I served with him here from 1959 to 68,
mm-hmm.
He became more liberal and I think in all his views during those years. And at the time when he left to go to the State University at New Paltz in 1968, I think he was quite a different administrator, person, philosophy, than when he came to Morehead State 10 years earlier. And all of those changes they went along different lines. They were good, but they were different than,
mm-hmm.
And I'd say moving more to the left, and where he started out in kind of the middle of the road, were always very liberal on civil rights and anything like, mm-hmm. all of those issues, very, I wouldn't call them radical, but very, very liberal.
Yeah.
But then I think many of his other ideas moved further left as years went by.
Now, you had 9 years with him, and then you had another, 15 or 17 with Roland?
That's right.
Roland Dill as, mm-hmm. as president. Inevitably, we need to compare the two. Mm-hmm. And how would you compare them as far as style, as far as impact on the institution, relationship to the system as a whole, and some of the various categories mm-hmm. of performance that we've looked at as far as Neumeier.
Well, Neumeier was here more during the rapid growth and the change years. The big changes took place. But Roland was here several of those years too as a faculty member and as a dean and vice president. And Roland, it always appeared to me, was very much in sync with John Neumeier's ideas on what higher education should be. And I think that's one of the reasons why Roland became the president, because John had been popular and mm-hmm. Roland had many of these same ideas.
Did John really, was he influential in designating Roland as the heir apparent?
I think that he did not make the choice, but I think he was influential mm-hmm. with mm-hmm. the board and strongly supported Roland in this position. John had great admiration for Roland. He mm-hmm. He just liked who he was, the way he thought, the way he could articulate views and express himself. And so I think that the college had a direction at the time that Roland came in, that hadn't been, we hadn't reached the goals yet, but we were off in a direction. Roland supported those things, and I think he came in and with a conscious effort to keep the the university moving in the same direction as it had under John, but with his own imprint, of course. And from 1968 on, of course, the university continued to grow. We had some years when we didn't grow. In fact, we got a little bit smaller, but I think the same type of commitments were there. Roland was an extremely intelligent person, a very effective communicator, was is highly respected by the State University Board at that time and has continued to be in that position all the way along. He's put his own imprint on the university and the, whatever it's been, the 68 to 80, 20, 21 years that he's been here. And he did keep on several of his administrative officers that John had had, and I felt at that time that that Roland probably should have had a little more choice in who he wanted in these positions, but he did indicate to us that he wanted us to continue to serve in those positions.
So you and Bob Hansen?
Yeah, Bob Hansen and myself, and let's see, who else? And
Bob McLeod.
Bob McLeod was just coming into the student services area as the dean of student services, and Roger Hamilton, and so Jerry Hockable was also had been in the education department, and right about that time had moved over to take more responsibility for public affairs. And so from that point of view, it was a little more difficult for Roland to maybe move with his own set of people.
He inherited
his cabinet, yeah. And he decided to keep those people on. And I just think it worked out, from my point of view, it worked out well for the university. But maybe at times he might have been a little frustrated. I don't know that he was.
Yeah.
I don't think he was. But Roland, of course, has not only established himself within the Minnesota State University system as an outstanding president, but also has a national and even international reputation that that probably goes beyond what John had in his years here. And so the two are different, but in many ways they're similar. I think that Roland is maybe a little more relaxed. John was always moving with calculating. He was listening to every word that was said to see, well, how is this? Is this good? Is this bad? And so forth. Roland was a little more relaxed from that point of view. Roland, I feel, has always had aspirations beyond what he's been able, and I think many of us do, aspirations in directing the university and its accomplishments and so forth beyond what he's been able to achieve. And I think sometimes this frustrates him. And some of that, maybe he doesn't get the time to get all these things accomplished because he is more active in national circles and in the state and so forth. So they've been two good presidents. I think the direction of the university was set primarily during those earlier years in the 60s, late 50s and early 60s.
Let's we've been talking really kind of a overview of the institution and its a period of growth and its a period of establishing a new identity, which it seems to me is been very successful, and obviously you had a role in this. We haven't really given you an opportunity to talk about how you viewed your own job and how it changes the particular areas of responsibility. We talked a little bit about developing the physical plant, about finances, about personnel. But I think it would be interesting if you wanted to sketch the kind of evolution that occurred during those years, and more particularly your areas of response.
Well, in 59, John had been here 1 year, and there had been some previous administrations that, rightly or wrongly, had created certain unrest on the campus. And I would say that, as I perceived it when I came on board, that there had been, it hadn't been, some administrations prior to that had not been very open. And there had been many decisions made on the basis of what the president and some administrative officers. Now, you always hear this about institutions, probably, and so I don't know if there was any more here than or any less. But I came in with a commitment to run an open administration in my, at least in my areas. And my areas at that time, and basically throughout my tenure, have been the university finances, physical plant, both the planning, the construction, and the maintenance and operation of the physical plant, the classified staff, which is does not include the faculty but the support personnel, the bookstores, and in later years, computer services. So those are kind of the areas that I were under the umbrella of administrative affairs. And it seemed very important during those early years to open things up. And so that wasn't only my idea, that was John's feeling too. And when I, even when I came to the campus, there had been a whole host of committees established, or were in the process of being established, for university operations. And those committees, basically, at least in that number, and had not existed prior to John Neumeyer's coming.
Faculty had much of a role in governance.
Well, it was that's the way it appeared in looking back at it, that they had not had a voice in. And in my area, they hadn't been involved in budget planning. They hadn't been involved in building plans to any great degree. They didn't know how many staff were allocated to the university or how they were allocated out to departments and so forth. And so I would say that was a major thrust to open the administration, involve the faculty and staff and students in the administration of the university, and to the extent where it sometimes would just about drive you up the wall because you just couldn't get your work done. I think that John wanted people to get to know me, and so I was maybe on 10 or 12 committees when I came on board, and they would meet regularly, and preparing for those meetings, many of which were in related directly to my area, but some weren't, but those in my area that would require a certain amount of administrative work to prepare for the meetings. And they were helpful, but they took a lot of time. Mm-hmm. So calendar.
Democracy is
right,
expensive.
Right, that's right. It's expensive, and particularly when you come from a operation that had been more closed, at least, and to some reports, very closed. I mean, like when I came, there were budget documents in the bottom drawer, and departments didn't know where a predecessor someplace along the line had been working on them, but nobody knew what their budgets were for a department. They didn't have any idea of these things. And so we opened up that whole process and truly invited input into it, because I certainly didn't come to the university with great experience or great wisdom in these areas other than to try to find out where the needs were and then try to get the resources to the needs. And so while that took a great deal of time, it did establish, I think, a confidence in the administration, and doors were open to people whenever they wanted to come in, where prior to that, I think that you'd maybe make appointments to see somebody on a specific item and so forth. So we spent a lot of time changing that.
Yeah.
Environment.
I was still in evidence very definitely when I came on board in 1972, and I just as an aside, I think we need some outside evaluation of your success at this point. I'll quote Val McManus, who was Vice Chancellor for Administrative Affairs. He at one time told me that he would like to take you and have you visit each campus for at least 2 weeks at a time and establish the budget development process that is was in existence at Morehead State because he considered a model. And that, I thought, was pretty impressive coming mm-hmm. from him.
Well, that's very nice to hear, because it did take a lot of effort. And we did, as you mentioned, as Val mentioned, we did establish then in the following years budget procedures where people knew just what was going to happen, just when, and what the amount of resources were available. And on buildings, any determination, we would survey the faculty and the administration to determine where their physical plant needs were, where they were crowded. And of course, we would know from the registrar when the classroom situation was getting unbearably tight, like it is right now again at the university, after we thought the big growth would be over. Now it's back again. I promised the legislative committee one time that we could see the light at the end of the tunnel.
No more buildings.
If we could maintain what we had, that would probably take care of our needs. Did not turn to... I also predicted one time before the Kiwanis Club, or in a talk to them, that Morehead State would reach 10,000 students. And shortly after that, we started going down. But now we're getting close, but I'd hear about that once in a while.
Yeah.
But in those areas, we did work hard. And I guess what I've learned, and I hope to have followed, is to hire good people and really search for good people to head up these areas. And in many cases, we've succeeded, maybe not all the times in my area, but to hire good people and give them responsibility and make them accountable for their areas. But that's the way to accomplish things. And so I moved from, when I first came, to a hands-on position where I was filling out, buying every piece of equipment for every building and working on every line and every blueprint with the architects, and
hiring every
janitor
person,
and
yeah.
clerical person, to one where it was very much an overseeing and setting of policy and handling specific problems and setting directions and those types of things. So it's been very rewarding. It's,
mm-hmm.
You know, I used to say to Bob Hansen, Bob would get frustrated once in a while or frequently and working in the academic areas and running into what he would perceive as obstacles. They may have been, may not have been, but holding up, moving ahead on programs. And I would be over in my area, left relatively alone by the presidents, and moving ahead and seeing buildings planned and constructed and occupied. You know, it was just and seeing budgets move along. I had much more tangible, it appeared to
right.
me anyway, much more tangible response and reinforcement from the things that I was working in. So I always found the job very rewarding,
mm-hmm.
with certain exceptions, of course.
Sure, sure. Well, those exceptions would be inevitable in any position, but the bottom line is still pretty strongly positive. Your relationship with the state and the state system, we've talked a little bit about the level of autonomy and centralization. Obviously, part of your responsibility was meeting with representatives or your peers from the other institutions. Is there anything about that that is worthy of note? And then I think it would be interesting also to, you had a major responsibility in your membership on the Higher Education Facilities mm-hmm. Committee. In fact, you chaired it, didn't
right.
you?
I have yeah. chaired it now
yeah.
for a number of years.
You're chairing it now,
mm-hmm.
yeah. Okay. Why don't we say a few words about both of those things?
Well, as we became more, having a more centralized office in St. Paul, the Chancellor's office, and the legislative staff working with the Chancellor's office and the Chancellor's office working with us, it became much more paramount in the later years that we have a good, close working relationship with the Chancellor's office and with the staff there and the Vice Chancellors and with our other vice presidents, with our other counterparts at the state universities. because we were all facing similar type of problems, and what impacted on one of us invariably impacted on the other. And in order to find ways to meet these challenges, solve the problems, whatever the case might be, we would have periodic meetings, usually monthly meetings, in St. Paul or on one of the campuses that would involve my counterparts and then the vice chancellor for business and finance from the board office. And these meetings were very important. They allowed us to exchange ideas, anticipate problems before they were there, to develop new techniques for moving the campuses ahead. And so I have a group of colleagues there that I'm very much indebted to, it, whether it's Mankato, St. Cloud, Winona, Bemidji, Southwest, or whatever school I left out there.
Metropolitan,
yeah. And so that was important. It depended on a little bit on the chancellor and the vice chancellor and the president at our own institution as to how much interchange there was. And it would vary from time to time. But overall, we received good support and from those people that I mentioned so that we could meet and compare notes and make decisions on how everything from how budgets are going to be allocated. You know, some of the schools were heavier in graduate programs, and if they got the chancellor's ear and the vice chancellor's ear, well, all of a sudden the allocations would become much heavier for graduate credits than they were for undergraduates, and then they'd maybe teach the graduate programs with graduate assistants rather than faculty, and so maybe they didn't need the money they were arguing for. And we would work out a lot of these problems in these types of meetings. On the other item you mentioned, I have had really non-campus responsibilities of a statewide nature. I was appointed by Governor Wendell Anderson to serve on the Higher Education Facilities Authority in 1972, and those were for four-year terms, and somehow I've managed to remain on the Facilities Authority, even with
four-year terms.
I was appointed by a Democratic governor, so you can figure out, and I was reappointed by Governor Perpich a couple of times. Mm-hmm. But there were other Republican governors in there in the meantime, too. So I have served on that agency, which is a quasi-state agency that was established by the legislature and given the authority to sell tax-exempt bonds for capital improvements for higher education in the state of Minnesota. And what that really comes down to, because state higher education facilities get their appropriations for physical plant capital improvements directly from the legislature, it leaves it at the private colleges primarily are the ones that are our clients. And they come to us with their building plans, and we do not try to get involved in the planning or really much in the identification of need. But we do get into it from the point of view of financial feasibility, whether they're able to. We have bond counsel and finance counsel, and we set up the sale of bonds for schools. And I think we've had well over 50, 60 sales in the years that I've been on. It was established in 1972, and while I wasn't an initial appointment, I came on during the first year. And total dollars of probably $180 million in bond issues that have been issued for virtually all of the private colleges in the state of Minnesota. I think Concordia College and Moorhead here has had four bond issues go through us. And the Facilities Authority, in most cases, owns the building. It's leased to the college. This is technically, we own the building, leased back to the college till the bonds are paid, although there have been a variety of financing techniques, and that's not the case in all situations.
That enables, then, a private institution to benefit from the tax-exempt, the issuance of tax-exempt bonds. Is that
That's right, and probably might save them 2 or 3% on the cost of financing.
Mm-hmm. Essentially, the state underwrites them. And
no, it the
so suppose the, there were the a higher default.
The Higher Education Facilities Authority started out with a loan from the Higher Education Coordinating Board. And within the first few years, that loan was repaid, and we're totally self-supporting on the basis of fees that we charge the private.
So it's a revolving fund.
So we establish a reserve fund, mm-hmm. and that reserve fund is intended to... last water, but... that reserve fund is intended to assure bondholders that if there is a default, we can pay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think we're going to ask Lee if we can get a glass of water.
Well, I was just mentioning about the facilities authority and that we are self-supporting, and basically the cost of operating the our small office with an executive director and two secretaries is paid by the fee that the private colleges pay to have us sell the bonds. We have had one default. Golden Valley Lutheran mm-hmm. College of Minneapolis has defaulted, but we have paid the...
You had the reserve that enabled you to to come up with that and cover that. We've asked you to talk. Obviously, Morehead State was a part of the community of Morehead, and most of the people who were active in the administration also had community roles, and I think it'd be interesting if we if you gave us a kind of rundown of your role there as working within the community.
Well, over the years I've served on a lot of community committees and been involved in events and things like that. I guess the ones that come to mind now are I'm currently on the City of Morehead Task Force for the Conference Convention Center, and that's a group that's met the last about two and a half years working towards the construction of a hotel and a conference convention facility in downtown Morehead, and that's been rewarding, and it's taken some time, but I've enjoyed that very much. I've been on the Morehead Chamber of Commerce Board of Directors and went off of that at the time that I retired. I was on the board at that time. I've been on Trinity Church Council in the late 1970s, early 1980s, and served as president of the Trinity Council in 1980. I'm currently serving as vice chair of our building committee at Trinity, where we're going to planning a major addition to the church. I'm also serve on a newly created board for St. Ansgar St. John's Hospital called Assisi, which is a board that will be devoted to profit-related activities of the hospital association, but health-related things, such as providing offices for medical staff and a variety of things. That's so new that I'm not sure all the things that we might cover. We've just had one meeting on that. Serve on the we live during the summers at Pelican Lake, and I'm on the Pelican Lake Homeowners Association. In the past, I've served on several special committees for the Morehead School Board, particularly with regard to physical plant and financial needs of the school district, and I don't know, a variety of other things. That's kind of some of the okay. things I think about.
Obviously, one of our hopes in creating these tapes is to give some sense of who you are, and we certainly covered that very adequately, it seems to me, professionally. But personally, I think it's pretty important that we get make a matter of record who you are as far as Earl, the father and okay. husband.
All right. Well, Ruth and I were married in 1950, which is a nice round number to remember anniversaries from, and so we have five children. And by the way, Ruth's maiden name was Ruth Swenson. She also comes from Minneapolis. And we have five children, And the oldest is Pam, and she's married to Chuck Wettstein, and they have three children and live in Corpus Christi, Texas. He's an engineer for a large petroleum company. And next daughter is Vicky, married to Paul Hogvit, and they have three children, and they live in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And the third daughter, Cindy, married to Russ Olson, they have two children, and Cindy had worked at Morehead State University up until last summer. She had been associate registrar here and is now the registrar at Metropolitan State University in St. Paul. And Russ works, has a new business in St. Paul also. And then Roberta, Bobby, is married to Mike Pacchetti, and they have two children. They live in a suburb of Minneapolis. And our youngest is David, and he's recently completed his baccalaureate degree from the University of Wisconsin, and then gone on and got his master's degree, or got another baccalaureate degree, I should say, from Morehead State in teaching, and is currently looking for work and substitute teaching in the Fargo-Moorhead area.
Okay. I have kind of led the way as far as providing leading questions to hopefully get a chance for us to really get a vision of what you've been doing as it relates to the university and the community, but I could well have left out a lot of important things. Are there some things that you would like to get on tape that we haven't covered?
Well, I think that we have covered things pretty well, and as you say, there's a lot of things left out, and apologize to anybody particular that I should have mentioned that I've left out, because there's been so many key people. And I feel extremely fortunate to have moved along a path that brought me to Morehead State, and there could be so many paths. If it was ever done again, I'm sure it's got to be some kind of luck and so forth. But to be at an institution that was growing and serving the students and the people of this state so well, you just feel that, and to be a part of that is a tremendous reward. And people that I've mentioned on the tape, like you, Bill, and Bob Hansen, and Bob McLeod, and Jerry Hockabo, and Monty Lyons, and Les Johnson, were people just a top tip of the iceberg of the people. And I've mentioned many other people like Roland and John Neumeier and so forth here, that it's really been a pleasure to work with those people and to see the university move along in the direction that it has. Mm-hmm. I'm enjoying retirement very much so.
Well, I share in that. Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much. We'll wind this up then.
Thank you.